And as Steve, you might recognise that from a talk I gave at Kakadu a couple of years ago. Not a great deal has changed in terms of our issues for the Northern Territory. So I'll go quickly through what do we know, what are the main threats, how do we maintain resilience, we've heard that word today, and then what are the information gaps. There will be talking a lot more about that later on today. There seem to be three main pressures on us. We get too hot, we get too wet, at least up here, and in the coastal areas, and then cyclones. And I thought I'd give you first some global context of where we stand. I got connected to a bit of work that Steve was at an IUCN workshop, and then I got connected by providing data for an analysis, a global analysis of birds, amphibians, and corals. And the idea is that you can divide species up into those that are highly susceptible, that they're exposed to climate change and they're sensitive to us. There's some that will probably cope. They're exposed, but they have mechanisms to cope with it. You've got another group there that might adapt to climate change through behavioral or genetic changes. And then you've got some that are very rigid, but they're not actually going to be exposed to much climate change. So they're a latent risk. And then we did this for all the different species around the world. And so we came up with a fairly complex diagram. I'll just explain. So I want to do this just to put Australia in context. So if you're in a yellow area, you're going to be exposed to climate change. This is based on a bunch of the models. If you're blue, you're sensitive to them. So each species was assessed against its vulnerability to sea level rise, changes in temperature and rainfall, or with the corals, with ocean acidification. And then if you're in the purple area, you're both exposed and sensitive or unadaptable, so you're in deep trouble. So on the left-hand side, you have the numbers of species, and you can see South America is in trouble for the birds and amphibians as a measure. This is the proportion of species, and we're talking about polar bears and so forth. Well, in terms of, there's not many species, but they're in the Arctic, Antarctic, they're going to be in trouble. Amphibians, not many amphibians up in North East Asia, but and Australia, if you look at Australia, we've got, in a global context, we've got a lot of sensitive taxa, but they're not thought to be as exposed as the rest of the world. I thought it worth just looking at us in a global context for birds and amphibians. So this is a paper that's gone in. It hasn't been accepted yet. So it's going to get hotter, and obviously for some biodiversity too hot. Steve mentioned that there's not going to be much space for genetic variability, and I came across this picture in a paper in Proceedings of the Royal Society looking at toads and how they have coped with they've adapted to hotter climates over the last 30 years, and they've been found in hotter and hotter climates. But then it frightened me a bit that something like the toad can reach a limit of its genetic variability. We know of Rick Shine's work showing just how much this leading edge of toad invasion has been adapting to being a leading edge and getting longer legs, and so long that they're now getting arthritis, and then they all hopped west and then they hopped south, so you've got this natural selection going on in this leading edge of the toad population, but there's a genetic limits for these poor blighters, so they can't go. You know, Alice Springs will not get many toads for a while. But if the toad is limited, what about all these others? And Steve and others have done this great work on the possums in the rainforest that get what's the temperature for the lemuroid? 28.5. Yes. So much, very much cooler than a toad, and we just don't know that data for lots of things. And of course, it is going to get so much hotter in the territory. This is the number of days that we'll be getting extremes. Of course, a lot of things, Mike mentioned that there's an evolutionary history for all these species, of course, and here a lot of the animals and plants we have here today have, if they stayed in the same place, they've seen a lot of climate change go past them. This is from some time ago, when Kakadu was a bit like the Tennant Creek, really, the dry, low scrub. It's hard to imagine that now, and all the wetter environments were further north. And that's not so long ago in evolutionary terms. So, and this is what the Magala floodplain, I mean, there's actually, Bob Watson's on some cores out there, and this is probably what the floodplain looked like. Really, not very long ago at all. So it's, you're looking at quite major changes over short periods. They're just beyond our human horizon, so we can't appreciate what these animals and plants have managed to adapt to. But what they haven't had is, for a very long time, is hotter temperatures, the sorts of temperatures that are being modelled now. So it's been continental. It's been colder. Here it has sometimes been hotter, but a long time ago. There's many of the things in the sandstone country where we've got our endemics have coped with tougher conditions than they've got now, which are drier. And these lowland wetland systems that we're so proud of in the territory have existed elsewhere within their evolutionary history. So how can we cope with this? Well, there's been some talk of triage on species. So we went to this talk, Dave Bowman was getting up. I'll forget these things that are on the edge. But actually, we don't have to do that. I mean, we've signed agreements, the Convention on Biological Diversity, where we have said we will not let species go extinct, and we don't have to let species go extinct. And if we start letting species go extinct, there's no logical stopping place to say the triage will keep moving. There's you can't say we should let some species go and not others. So, and the other thing is that there's quite good evidence in the fossil record of species that are rare at one stage being common in the past. That you get a change in climate and some species will be advantaged. As Steve mentioned, some will get scarcer. So today's rare species might be common in the future under a different climate. And so we need to keep that genetic capacity. So this is shows that this is our equivalent of our mountains. We haven't quite got... I mean, the best thing we could do in the territory, really, for a lot of our species is build some very large mountains. Instead, we've got to look after as best we can the little dimples we have in Kakadu. And as I said, they've been through a lot already. There's a lot of microclimates in there where things have been able to hide. Whether they'll hide from the high temperatures, we shall find out. And that's an area of research, is to find out which ones we need to protect the most. So, okay, sea level is coming. We can't do anything about it. And there will be winners and losers, and obviously mangroves are going to be the winners, as they were 6,000-7,000 years ago when Kakadu and that whole area was a vast mangrove swamp. And so is that we've been there before when we had big areas of mangroves. We're likely to go there again, at least to start with. In the long term, if the water comes right up, it'll be like if you've been to the Kimberley, the coast of the Kimberley. It's a weird drowned landscape with the mangroves fringing this deep water. And you can imagine the same thing will be Kakadu, as it has been before, as shown in the stone art. And then things that need fresh water will diminish in abundance. Won't necessarily go extinct. They've seen it before. So how do we maintain it? Well, we shouldn't be trying to save landscapes. I actually think ecosystems it's pointless trying to keep these ecosystems as entities that we try and They're in our legislation. I think it's foolish to have it in our legislation because all the, you look through the paleo record and there have been changes in the mixes of species. And there will be changes in the future. So species will move along different environmental gradients. And so to try and, it's like Canute trying to stop the tide coming in, to try and stop landscapes changing. So we need to adapt to new landscapes, novel ecosystems are becoming a major topic of research. But there will be some systems that are worth keeping. And it's not going to all go in a rush. There will be some freshwater wetlands that we will be able to keep. We need to identify which of those are most likely to be retain their values. And a bit like the tops of the mountains that Steve was talking about, that's where we need to concentrate our management, keeping the weeds out, keeping the ferals down. And we need to enjoy them. I mean, mangroves are great places. And they're terrific for carbon, as Andrew has pointed out to our school. They're nurseries for fish. They're disappearing from so many places. We're going to have lots of them. We don't know that whether they're going to become more frequent or not. There's this feeling over the last 10 years that strong cyclones are more frequent. What that'll mean is that you get lots of trees knocked down and they'll be recovering. The consequences of that for biodiversity, we don't know. The consequences for carbon, we're starting to know. Gary, it's going to be really interesting to see the results of the recovery from Monica a few years ago. Have you been continuing that work, Gary? We've got research going on that, and of course there'll be bigger areas that are recovering. What that does is provide an opportunity for weeds to get in these disturbed environments, can then change the state of large areas. So to be resilient in the face of climate change, we've got to. There should be a big emphasis on controlling those weeds likely to invade the cyclone-affected areas. We need to do some planning for that. Where we need to do the monitoring, where we need to have focal control. Otherwise, it will be reactive. It'll be too late. Weeds can get away so quickly. So, what do we need to know? We need to know more about temperature thresholds. We'll come up with more ideas, I'm sure, in our conversation. Need to know more about the refuges and what's happening there. Vulnerabilities of species. How the floodplains may change. It won't be a uniform process of the sea level rising, the mangroves marching in and taking over everything. What happens is that as sea level rises, sediments get reworked. You get deposition in some places, erosion in others. It's a dynamic system. And the sorts of modelling that Eric Valentine has been doing in the harbour, we can do across larger areas to try and understand what might happen to, say, the Kakadu wetland. Post-cyclone weed control and prioritisation. We can't do it all at once. We need to know where our most cost-effective strategies should be put in place. That's all. Thank you.